So this is part three of my shiurim leading up to Sukkos, trying to prepare for Sukkos, but streaming Sukkos through the prism of the Yom Kippur War. In Eretz Yisrael, the Yom Kippur War is a, depending upon the calendar, but especially this year where there's a two-week offset between Yom Kippur and October 6th and 7th, which is when the war broke out. So the entire country is still processing. And when I say processing, it's not just in the media and in the culture, but there are askarot and memorials, and everyone knows someone, and there's always a connection, and these are very soulful and spiritual moments. So, especially for people in Chutz La'aretz for whom this is not an element of their Yom Kippur circus period, I hope that these shiurim are providing a slightly different voice and a slightly different angle to this period. So, Sukkos, of course, is known as the International Chag. The 70 parim, one par for each of the 70 nations. Obviously, in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, not just over Sukkos, but in general, we had more of a universalist stance. People would visit Yerushalayim, people would donate and dedicate to the Beis HaMikdash. Chiram helped build the Beis HaMikdash, Malchus Shavah came. Jewish identity, religious identity, is perched very delicately on that balance or that boundary between universalism and particularism, between our broader global agenda and our inner world of ritual and Torah mitzvahs. And of course, the two are not separate identities, but the two are a one merged identity. We're chosen to inspire the world, and the way we inspire the world is not just by being peacekeepers and educating people in seminars, but by bringing Hashem's presence into this world and keeping His mitzvahs and modeling a life of commandment and commitment. And for the last 2,000 years, the Jewish world shrunk. We weren't empowered to broadcast Hashem's message. We were on the margins. This is part of our punishment. And it's taking, I think, some people a while to shift back into that universalist stance. Anyway, so the great golden era of Jewish universalism is the first Beis HaMikdash, less than the second Beis HaMikdash, but still in the second Beis HaMikdash. So it's not just the Sukkos reality, it's something which characterized our dynasty and our monarchy. And Sukkos, though, was the Chag that accentuated this universalism because of the Korbanos, because the themes and the motifs of the day are much more universal. Obviously, Kibas Sukkos HaShavti Es B'nei Yisrael, this whole Yom Tov commemorates the protection Hashem afforded us in the desert, and that has connotations of a personal relationship between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and His people. Zacharti L'chesed Nirayich Avas Klosayich. So when we think about the Midbar, we don't think in universal terms. We think in very historical and national terms of us following Hashem, Mashachti Acharecha Narutza, as the beginning of Shir HaShirim says. So we don't think in universal terms, but all that being said, Hashgacha is Hashgacha, and Hashgacha is extended to all B'nai Adam, and particularly to human beings that are zochu to a higher level of Hashgacha. So unlike, let's say, Pesach, which celebrates Yitzias Mitzrayim of Am Yisrael, or Shavuos Matan Torah to Am Yisrael, the main motif of Sukkos is a more general, a more universal motif.
So that's why Sukkos was designated as the universalism, or the holiday and the Chag in which our universalism came to the fore, because of the Korbanos, because the theme and the motif is more general, because we prayed for rainfall, and praying for rainfall is something which the entire world depends upon. The Gemara in Tanis talks about how rain, wherever it falls because it falls in Eretz Yisrael first, so Eretz Yisrael became the waterways of the entire world. Presumably, Koheles is read on Sukkos for that reason. A very famous question, why is Koheles read on Sukkos? And part of the answer is because every other Megillah has a natural fit. So Shir HaShirim obviously fits Pesach, and Esther obviously fits Purim, and Rus obviously fits Shavuos. But part of the answer is the universalism of Koheles. This is the only Megillah that can be read by Jew and non-Jew more or less in the same way. When a non-Jew reads Shir HaShirim, so much of Shir HaShirim is about our long-lasting romance with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Of course, when a non-Jew reads Megillas Rus, this is about our ancestry and our dynasty. When a non-Jew reads Eicha, about our tragic non-Jew reads Esther. But Kohelis is universal. It's philosophy, it's theology, it's the meaning of life, the purpose of life. It's Elohim. The word Elohim appears more than Hashem because it's the universal God of judgment and justice. So it's appropriate to read Kohelis on Sukkot because that's the mood and that's the tone and that's where we are. So Sukkot is the chag of universalism, of sitting in the sukkah, of remembering our global universal mission, and that's why the Midrashim say that in the end of days, Goyim will complain, well, we would have been more religious and more pious and more committed had we received mitzvahs. So Hashem says, you know what, I'll give you a mitzvah and let's see how you respond to it. And what mitzvah do you think Hashem chooses? The mitzvah of sukkah. And he tests them, and unfortunately, many of the goyim don't pass the test. It becomes too hot, and then they despise the sukkah. They run out of the sukkah, and Hashem says, well, you see that you weren't able to keep this one mitzvah. But why does Hashem give them the mitzvah of sukkah, not the mitzvah of matzah, the mitzvah of tefillin? Because sukkah is a universal mitzvah on a universal chag, sitting under the protection of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Chag HaSukkos did, and one day will, and should continue to remind us of our universal mission. We're not put on this earth only to study and learn, but to study and learn and bring Hashem and perform mitzvos so that the entire world is educated and inspired, not to become Jewish, but to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as we said so often in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, V'yeda kol pol, k'yata pi'alto, v'yavin kol yitzor, k'yata yitzarta. Now, because we have a universal mission, that means that Jewish history and human history are intertwined. And what happens in the Jewish field of history drives the human historical trajectory. And again, that's something which is hard for us to see and maybe was a little bit less transparent during the 1900 years of our Galus, where we were pushed to the margins of society and it was hard to see where the Jewish arc was driving the broader arc of human history, but it always was, maybe in ways that are less discernible, less empirical. But as we veer towards redemption, and as we return to the historical stage, we more expect or greater expect to see the correlation between Jewish history and human history. And in particular, that correlation should be seen in Eretz Yisrael, because Eretz Yisrael is the engine of history. That's where human history began. That's where man was fashioned from, Yerushalayim. That's where history will end. So the history of the Jews in their land and in Yerushalayim should be associated. It should be easy for us to associate that with human history and to see its impact. Now, this impact of Jewish history upon human history became much more discernible in 1973 in the Yom Kippur War than it was in the earlier wars. The earlier wars had much less of an international element to it. Now, keep in mind, the build-up and the return to Eretz Yisrael was very international. The Balfour Declaration and the San Remo Conference and the 47 vote, November 29th, 1947. And we believe that if we are returning to Israel and reforming human history, then it should have international approval and international authorization. This is, of course, one of the very famous responses to the Satmar Rebbe's very, very harsh and, I'm going to say, infamous claim that Zionism was illegal, was unlawful, was a violation of the oaths that we took, cited by the Gemara in Ksuvos, that we shouldn't return and rebel and return to Eretz Yisrael. And many claimed that after the Balfour Declaration and after international authorization, we're not rebelling against the world by returning to Eretz Yisrael. We're merely asserting the rights that international organizations such as the UN have afforded us. And that's why receiving international approval, which we're in the process of, the treaties we've signed over the last 50 years, pretty much since 1973, now culminating in the Abraham Accords, and hopefully very soon, peace, official peace with Saudi Arabia and maybe other countries that will follow, because we're not here to redeem ourselves. We're here in Eretz Yisrael to redeem the world. So for us to redeem the world has to accept us, and that's not going to happen in one or two generations, but it's something we shouldn't give up on. It's a religious goal. It's a religious objective. It's a historical objective to receive the approval and the authorization of our surrounding neighbors. But despite the fact that the build-up to our return to Eretz Yisrael was part of a larger international dynamic, the first two wars we waged, the war of 1948, the war of 1967, didn't have that much of an international element to it. We defended our country. In fact, the British left, and that's what incited the war when the British left Palestine, so now we were left defenseless. 1967, we stood literally alone facing all the Arab nations that were about to invade us, and we didn't have help. 1973 was very, very international on many fronts. First of all, the war was fought not just by the Syrians and the Egyptians, but at least five or six other Arab divisions from other countries in ways that were probably similar to some of the other wars, but were very pronounced in this war. Jordan didn't join the war, interestingly enough. At a certain point in the war, airlifts, major airlifts began. The Soviet Union decided to arm Egypt, and they sent massive amounts of ammunition and weaponry. And then stunningly, which is really just a very interesting study, not for this quick podcast, Nixon, the President of the United States, who was not particularly known as a Jew lover, one could, as an understatement, but remember the Secretary of State was Henry Kissinger, who is a Jew, and he's still alive as I'm recording this year in 2023, sent even more larger amounts of ammunition and weapons to Israel in massive airlifts. I don't remember the name, but there was some. It was even called like the project. It was Nickel something. It was such a massive operation that it got a name, Operation such and such. I forget what Nickel something, Nickelback, Nickel something. I don't know what it was, but it got a name. And all of a sudden, the wars in Sinai and the wars in the Golan Heights, they were part of a larger Cold War dynamic, part of the face-off between West and East, between the Soviet Union and the United States. In fact, towards the end of the war, we had encircled the Egyptian Third Army. And instead of taking them captive or eliminating them, we had to walk away and back down because of the fear that the Soviet Union would actually enter the fighting on the side of the Egyptians to defend their Third Army. And Kissinger convinced us that this was true or not, this is a wise decision to walk away and to stand down rather than having Russia join the war. So there's much more of an internationalization of the war. The war becomes something not just between Israel and the Arabs, but between the United States and the Soviet Union. I mentioned before the universalism of sukkahs through the Korbanos, through Koheles, through the imagery of the sukkah. Well, perhaps the most, or one of the most universal features of sukkahs is the Haftarah of Shabbos Chol HaMoed sukkahs, the Haftarah of Gog Umagog, these large apocalyptic wars that we expect to happen sometime along the Messianic timeline. And of course, everyone's always looking for what is the Gog Umagog war? Which is the war? Is it going to be World War II? Is it a nuclear war? Well, there's an interesting Vilna Gaon that says that all of our tefillos throughout the centuries have in some ways mitigated the potential impact of a Gog and Magog war, and that the Gog and Magog war doesn't have to be one single major world war conflagration. It could be a series of small wars and skirmishes, again, because we've davened so hard and because of our mitzvos and Maisim Tovim. So was the Yom Kippur War part of the Gog and Magog complex of wars? That's impossible to answer. We don't really know the answers of Mashiach in the end of days till Mashiach happens. But it certainly had that larger international framework or background. The other wars didn't. And not just the war itself, but the aftermath of the war. Remember, during the war and during its aftermath, the Arab countries applied an oil embargo against countries that had been friendly and supportive of Israel. I remember as a child, the gas shortages, waiting in line, odd days, even days to match your license plate when you were allowed to get gas, when you were allowed to get gas. I remember it was 1973. Many people listening may not have been alive then, but I certainly remember the gas shortages. It's actually a miracle that America supported Israel despite not just the threats of an oil embargo, but suffering the oil embargo. And all of a sudden, it became a larger-than-life, larger-than-military experience where people were struggling to receive sources of energy. And in fact, one could claim that the last 50 years, in which humanity is striving and pursuing new forms of energy, began in earnest in the oil shortages of 1973. Today we associate the search for alternate energy with an environmentalist agenda to protect the earth, which is certainly legitimate and important. But I think it began more as an economic need, because we realized that the Arab oil fields were no longer dependable because they could be shut off depending upon the political intrigue and political situation. So 1973 was much, much more universal. Happened over Sukkot, and it reflected the tone of Sukkot. And without becoming too prophetic or too ambitious, was it part of the Gog and Magog series of wars? That's hard to know. But it certainly reminded us of the theme of Sukkot, that we are a nation chosen to inspire the world, and that because we're chosen to inspire the world, our history is their history. And not just as Rabbi Sacks said, our past history is their history. The Exodus, Yetzias Mitzrayim, the statements about morality and civil society and just and fair society rather than a society driven by might and power. But the future in Jewish history drives human history. And this started to become apparent in 1973 and, of course, continues to be apparent to this day.